Stoney, thanks for joining us. In your career, you've talked about how you were 65, 70% curveball. When you see what Clayton Kershaw has been able to do over his career with that curveball, now going over 3,000 strikeouts for a career, what do you think, as a curveball expert, makes his so special?
Well, I think when he threw harder, the curveball was actually better because it had tremendous break on it. I mean, you know, going back and looking at some of the archive footage of various pitchers, you could take a look at Sandy Koufax's curveball, and it looked like it was suspended on a string, and then all of a sudden the bottom just dropped out of it, and whoever was hitting had to hit it almost like a lumberjack. You're almost chopping at it straight down. And when Kershaw's was right, it was very similar to that because he got so much spin on it that the ball broke so late and it almost, you could hear it spinning. It looked like it was just hanging there and all of a sudden, boom, it just exploded straight down and nobody could hit it. So I think we're seeing, and there's a very good chance we're seeing the last of the 3,000 strikeout guys with Clayton Kershaw. I know Chris Sale has a chance, but he's got to stay healthy. There's a few other guys that have chances, but again, they have to stay healthy, Garrett Cole being one of them. He's had a hard time staying healthy of recent vintage. So when you realize just how long you have to go and how healthy you have to be, it's really a monumental accomplishment. And kudos to Clayton Kershaw because he's been one of the greats.
So Walter Johnson, you know, is the standard bearer for strikeouts. He gets his 3,000th in 1923. It's not until Bob Gibson, 51 years later, that a second pitcher gets there. And then while you're playing, Stoney, it's Gaylord Perry and it's Nolan Ryan and Seaver and Carlton and Fergie and Don Sutton and Phil Niekro. I mean, so like, but so that number, what did you make of strikeout numbers like that as you were pitching and doing what you were doing?
Well, there was a lot of different type of baseball around. These guys were throwing 300 innings a year. I mean, they were on, many of them were on four-man rotations later on after the Mets went to five. There's a lot that went to five. But four-man rotation, you're getting a whole lot of innings per year and a whole lot of strikeouts. I mean, Nolan Ryan has 5,700-plus strikeouts. Mm-hmm. That's one of those things that you look at it and you go, yikes, what an amazing thing. And one of the reasons why he's been around that and the wins to get into the Hall of Fame, and deservedly so. But yeah, we're seeing I think the end of a breed that for many years was able to dominate using just overwhelming stuff and striking out a whole lot of guys. And that was, you got to understand something, that was during a time when a lot of guys took pride in not striking out. And now nobody really cares because a lot of the analytics folks says an out is an out. There's no such thing as productive outs, they're only outs. But for me, productive outs are still important, and watching the guys go through what they're going through now and realizing that it's just a matter of not hanging around the game. It's not that the stuff isn't the same stuff it was before. I mean, the great stuff is just, it's always going to be great. You're going to look at Paul Skeen's stuff, and you can favorably link his stuff with some of the greatest in the game. All he's got to do is hang around for another 20 years and we'll see some numbers like that, but that's easier said than done.
Do you ever worry that there might be young pitchers who are maybe being pushed away from really developing a curveball because everyone's about velo, velo, velo?
Well, I think that's one of the things, Lawrence, but I think there's another factor, and that is that I personally believe there's a couple of pitches that are more devastating on your elbow than the curveball. One being the splitter. I think that's absolutely destructive. I mean, Roger Craig taught everybody on his San Francisco Giant team many years ago. He taught each and every one of them how to throw the splitter, and they were very effective for a very short period of time, and then his entire pitching staff dissolved with elbow issues. I think that the splitter is one of the more devastating. I think also with these guys trying to get depth on sliders that are now 92, 93 miles an hour. It used to be, when that pitch was invented, it was called a nickel curve. You actually, now you would call it a cut fastball, but that's how the slider was initially developed. It was developed to move about 3 or 4, maybe 5 inches, take it off the sweet spot of the bat, and move straight across, and because you were cutting your fastball, it wasn't a whole lot of strain on your elbow. Then all of a sudden everybody felt, you know what, we're throwing this slider here, so let's try to get some depth on it. let's not only allow the curveball to give you depth, let's get the slider to give you depth. The only problem is that it's 92, 93 miles an hour. And now you're trying to get depth, which puts an incredible amount of torque on that elbow. And it's leading to record numbers of Tommy John surgery. So I think there's a lot more destructive pitches than the curveball, although people like to use the curveball as an example because of kids before their arms are developed, kids actually throwing curveballs and wind up getting hurt. But I'm not sure the curveball by itself is the culprit. I think the other things are, as well as the curveball and the velocity that everybody's throwing these days.
The splitter is making a bit of a comeback, Steve, because you're right. It was, I mean, it's widely thought to have hurt elbows. It was kind of a dark art to have it taught for a while, but it's making a comeback. Did you ever fiddle with one? Did you try?
Yes, I did. In fact, I was looking for a changeup, couldn't find one, and decided to split my fingers a bit because I knew it would slow down the ball if I did that, and it kind of morphed into a splitter. But I did throw so many curveballs, even though I threw the splitter the second half of the 1979 season. I threw it exclusively at that period and was undefeated from the All-Star break on, but the splitter was doing some bad things to my elbow, and then when I discarded the splitter, went to a couple more speeds of curveball, things worked out pretty well. But yeah, to me, because I threw so many breaking balls, so many curveballs, the splitter was just too difficult on my arm in conjunction with that curveball.
I had so much fun watching Grant Taylor last night in the eighth inning. And I'm like, here we go. I'm going to bring him back out for the ninth. He had a two-inning save last week as you were there on the weekend at Guaranteed Rate. And he went for it last night. And he lost it. What happened? As you're watching, what do you think happened? He got two walks on eight straight pitches, and then Will came out and took him out instead of letting him try to figure it out and finish it. And it's just, it was an interesting ninth that I didn't expect to be watching unfold that way.
Well, I understand what they're trying to do with Taylor, and that's trying to figure out how he'd be best served. They used him as a starting pitcher in the minor leagues. I think he's the closest thing we have to a closer in this entire organization. I understand the philosophy of trying to get him two-inning saves, although I don't think you can recreate Goose Gossage. If you take a look at how many multi-inning, multi-out saves he had, it was unbelievable, and he was able to make the Hall of Fame. Again, arms like that don't come around too often, and he had a special one, as illustrated by the fact he spent so much time in the back end of a bullpen and still was able to get the numbers up to make the Hall of Fame. But I'm not sure at this point what the destiny is going to be for Taylor, but I prefer one-inning saves personally if I'm trying to make a closer. I don't want necessarily to take a guy who's never closed before or closed very infrequently, let's say, and now all of a sudden you're asking him for multi-out saves in the major leagues. I understand trying to expose him to various other things. However, I think if, in fact, they want him to be a closer, teach him to do what closers do. And almost without exception, they don't go especially back-to-back multi-out saves, more than the three, the four hitters you might face trying to get the three outs, but usually it's one inning or something like that.
Stoney, what's the argument for who should get the honor of representing the White Sox at the All-Star game?
Well, that's a real good question at this point. I mean, I thought Smith would have had it pretty much for sure, but then three outings that have been lackluster at this point. And I think what he's starting to realize is what a lot of guys do in their first year, especially as a starting pitcher. It's very difficult to pick up 30 to 32 starts in a major league season, especially when you're not used to it. And then you're taking a guy who has not been in a major league starting rotation. Suddenly he finds himself in one, and all of a sudden realizing, you know what? You can get a little tired by doing that, especially if you haven't done it before. And so they're seeing the result of maybe a little arm fatigue and doing the things and trying to do what they can to make sure that he's 100% when he goes out there. But he's had these three bad outings in a row. I don't know how that's going to affect it. So, yeah, it's a challenge to see who's going to get there. I'm looking at the numbers, and I'm wondering, you know, exactly who it's going to be, but who knows? Maybe at the end of the day, when you look at the numbers, maybe it's Meidroth. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you could make a case for Miguel Vargas, but can you make a case for Adrian Hauser? Has he pitched enough? He's been great.
Yeah, I think if you're looking at the seven starts that I've seen, you realize that he's throwing as well as just about anybody in the game. And so, yeah, it's seven starts. It's not much. He probably is going to get another couple before the All-Star break, you would assume. So maybe that is enough. I mean, in lieu of having a better candidate, that might be the guy that you go to and choose him, because he's been pretty much lights out each and every one of those starts.
It's an interesting thing when you're trying to spin multiple plates in the middle of a rebuild. They need people to pitch and eat innings in August and September as well. But do you trade both Hauser and Savali? I mean, if you can get anything for either of them, because I don't know who comes up and pitches.
Well, I think you certainly trade one, and if I were to trade one, I would assume that Hauser has much more value than Savali at this point. I mean, Hauser has been terrific, and if you're thinking about acquiring a pitcher for the stretch run and the playoffs, I don't think you could make a case for Aaron Savali at this point. But I think you could for Adrian Hauser. I think when you look at that stuff and realize what he's done over the course of those seven starts, you realize that if he maintains that same stuff, you can take him, you can give him the ball in the second or third game of a playoff series and not feel bad about it, because he's had magnificent control to go along with overwhelming stuff at times. So, yeah, I would say that particular deal would have some legs on it, certainly would have some value. I'm sure that Chris Getz is dealing all kinds of phone calls, and certainly one of the names mentioned is Hauser, and it's probably mentioned very frequently.
Stoney, I've been stuck when it comes to Miguel Vargas, and Speaks has been on it. He's been talking about the offensive improvement of Vargas. For positional growth, I feel like it's more valuable for him to play third. What do you think? Like, what's the argument to keep playing him at first when there are usually more guys that can play first than can play third?
Yeah, I think if you were looking at just the entire future, you would say, well, put him at third base, leave him there, see what happens, because he's going to be a third baseman. But when you're looking for winning games now, and that's the difference between your front office and your general manager and your manager and his coaches. The manager and your coaches have to have a much shorter vision than the general manager and his front office, because they're thinking about winning not only this year, but they're thinking about winning next year and the year after, and how this team fits together and who's going to be where when everything shakes out. And I think you'd probably feel pretty good about Vargas starting at third base just about every day. But as far as winning now, you want to get the strongest aspect of your team in, and sometimes the strongest aspect is moving Miguel around to first base and then filling in with whoever, whether it's Rojas or anybody else, gives you another left-handed bat against a right-handed starter. So that's what the short version is. The long version is that you develop Miguel, and I'm sure that he is an accomplished enough third baseman to figure that that's going to be his spot down the road. But eventually, yeah, you might not want to move him back and forth. You might want to leave him in one spot. But that, again, is something that you're looking at down the road as opposed to today.
He was there getting his World Series game, World Series ring.
And I think that's exciting, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. But, you know, Lawrence was like, hey, I only played 30 games. How does it feel? They traded you away. And then they go out and they win it without you. But it's an odd feeling, I would assume, for a ball player. But he deserves it.
Yeah, I mean, look, he was a part of their organization, and they saw fit to bring him up for, you know, a little over a month as far as games are concerned. And so, you know, he deserves it. He's going to get it. He's going to keep it and pass it down to his family, I'm sure, one day. It's something to be proud of anytime you get one of those rings, and I'm sure he's very happy to have gotten it.
So we were talking about this the other day. Do broadcasters get World Series shares?
I would say, all things considered, no. However, it doesn't mean that the team can't vote them a certain amount, although they usually don't. You can understand that. There's the occasional guy that would get some of that. But I think, you know, look, if I had a choice of either the broadcasters or the traveling secretary, I would give it to Ed Casson, because he's been around a long time and works awfully hard. He's one of the great traveling secs around. I'm not sure if he gets the automatic full share. I think the players have to vote on it. But that's the guy to give a full share to if you're looking to find another share.
That's gracious, like the guys who actually do the work to help make everything happen.
Imagine that. Yeah, you give it to the guys who do a great job and make it easier on you and your family in the course of a season. And, yeah, to me, those guys are the guys that deserve whatever share it is. However, that being said, I think the White Sox are at least a half a season away from cutting the pie.
I think you're right about that, at least. next week, we're going to start the celebrations of the 2005 team. What are you most looking forward to when it comes to going back over what happened 20 years ago?
Well, I was not here when that happened. I mean, I was watching it from afar. I was working a couple of national broadcasts at that point. But I obviously remember the team very well. I remember exactly how they did it. And I remember that was a really talented group of guys. And when you look back and you look at the players who made up that team, you'll realize there was some stars on that team. I mean, you know, that was no fluke. That team played wonderful baseball, and it was, you know, it was real exciting for the fans, quite obviously. So exciting that they'd like to see it again sometime soon, sometimes in, you know, in all of our lifetimes, let's say.
A very old school run, considering how much they leaned on the starting rotation of that team.
Yeah, I mean, as well, starting rotation was just outstanding, as illustrated by the playoffs. You saw four straight complete games. You're not going to see that, but the rotation was very good. They had a couple of great years out of the bullpen, and when you're going to win, you know, you have the Cliff Felice of the world that come through and throw very well out of the pen, maybe the best year they ever had. You need guys to surprise you. You need some guys coming up from the minor leagues. You need some veterans recapturing some of the past glory. You need a lot of different teams, a lot of different surprises from your team to be able to win it all. And the Sox, if you look at exactly what happened that year and how it happened, you'll realize there were some surprises, not only the bullpen, but there was lots of other surprises coming around.
Steve Stone, this was great stuff, man. We appreciate you. Thanks so much.
Okay, guys, have a good rest of the show, and I'll talk to you down the road.